Why donate to CJSF 90.1 FM's annual fund drive? To help fund independent journalism in a rapidly shifting media landscape. To support local and independent artists who get invaluable FM airplay they can't get anywhere else. To provide a platform for underrepresented and marginalized voices. And to feel awesome about contributing to your community. Be awesome with us and donate now to CJSF 90.1 FM. Our fund drive runs from October 30th to November 5th. Donate at cjsf.ca/donate.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, lonely, risky acts, academic and political. A Canadian political scientist condemned for attending a forum in Russia and asking Vladimir Putin a leading question.
Some people are upset about me. Fine. If they had done their job, I wouldn't have had to do any of this. I feel that this is my duty as a Canadian because I care about Canada, because I care about Canada not taking the wrong positions.
And a social scientist gets fired for refusing to fly back to work from the other side of the planet. Slow travel releases less carbon.
I'm not sure if ethically I have to take a responsibility of what my compatriots did in the past and are doing now, but I'm trying to do what I can. I really wanted to be consistent with my commitment through actions, not just through words.
Before setting sail, help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Nothing more powerful than a lonely personal act. Consider Greta Thunberg or Gianluca Grimalda. When Grimalda's German bosses told the Italian climate researcher to come back to work fast from the other side of the planet, Grimalda said no, he'd come back slow. A 32-hour airplane journey from Papua New Guinea to Germany would generate 5.3 tons of earth-warming CO2. Slow travel by ocean freighter and train would generate 420 kilos, 12 times less. Grimalda got the boot. A hard hit, but Grimalda is philosophical. He told the 1,800 participants in his climate research project in Bougainville that he'd return to Europe low carbon. He didn't want to be seen as a yaman, a liar, or a fraudster in the Solomon Islands language. And honest researchers are the foundation of credible climate science. I reached Gianluca Grimalda on a freighter docked in Rabaul, East New Britain, on the Bismarck Archipelago of Papua New Guinea. Hello, Gianluca Grimalda. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Hello, David. A pleasure to be here.
Gianluca, can you tell me, just introduce yourself briefly and tell me where you are?
Yes, I'm a researcher in social sciences applied to climate change. So I investigate the social adaptation to climate change, among other things. And at the moment, I'm in Rabaul, East New Britain province of Papua New Guinea. I've just finished the first leg of my slow travel back to Europe from the Solomon Islands. I have spent close to 7 months here to do research on adaptation to climate change and adaptation to globalization.
And you had been working with the Keele Institute.
For the World Economy, that's correct. And I received the notification of my dismissal when I was here on the 11th of October, 9 days ago.
And quickly, tell me about that. They wanted you to come back quickly, and you said, I can't fly, I want to take a cargo ship. And they said, no, you got to get back here quickly. Tell me about that and what happened.
Yes, basically, that is really what happened. So I have been working for the Keele Institute for more than 10 years, and they know very well that I do conscientious objection to flying. So I only take planes when there is really no alternative. And that has never been a problem in the past. And even for this fieldwork, we agreed on a five-week allowance for the outbound trip and for a seven-week allowance for the inbound trip for me to slow travel. So normally these would be days that my institute counts as working days, because it is true, I actually work while I travel. But this time they were concerned about me traveling through Iran and Pakistan, that are considered difficult countries. And so we came to an agreement whereby I would travel on my holidays and on unpaid leave, in order for them not to, you know, get in trouble with the insurance. Because if something happens to me while I travel, the insurance must cover, so they would have responsibility. They would be accused not to look after their employees. So, yeah, that was reasonable. So there was a kind of, you know, bargaining between my head of department and the presidencies of my institute. Actually, in the end, they told me, we'll make it look like that you travel on unpaid leave, but in practice, we'll pay you back, we'll give you some compensation through the reimbursement. So this was the agreement. And the problem was that this fieldwork lasted much longer than originally planned. It lasted 7 weeks longer because a lot of things happened. There were major security threats. At some point, me and my assistant were held hostage of basically gangsters, ex-combatants wielding machetes, asking a ransom for the release of my belongings. And there was another security threat that we dodged of this type. There was a volcano activity, so that we had to cancel an entire area of villages that we had scheduled. So, I mean, there were many things that happened. It wasn't me, you know, lazing out on a beach. And I kept informed my head of department, my immediate supervisor. I did not inform the personnel office. And so when eventually the news came out, because I told them that I would be late, then, yeah, the presidency of my institute was not amused, to say the least. And they summoned me to a video call on the 27th of September. And they issued an ultimatum. So they said that either you come back in 5 days or you are fired. And I thought, I mean, I really couldn't believe my eyes, because really there is no point in me going back to Kiel in working at my office, because all my work can be done remotely as well as at the office in Kiel. You know, I spend most of my time at my office in Germany, just, you know, being alone in my office, just talking through Skype. I don't have teaching, I don't have meetings to attend. So I thought that their request was really, really unreasonable. And so my immediate reaction was to say, no, I'm not going to fly back. And then they said, okay, so you must be aware that we are going to fire you. And they said, okay, then go ahead and fire me. I really could not accept what I interpreted as a kind of, you know, act of submission, because they basically wanted me to renege on my principles and to just obey their orders. So I thought there was something kind of authoritarian. And yeah, I just couldn't cope with it.
So my question is, you'd think that one would think that the Kiel Institute, which is engaged in social science research largely revolving around climate change and climate risks, and this is your area, it would be to their credit that one of their researchers preferred really not to fly and was traveling in a slow fashion, and that this could almost be something to be proud of for the Institute.
And actually, I must add that in 2019, I traveled again. I slow traveled from Germany to Tokyo to attend a conference that was very important for my institute too. And they really showcased my experience. So they had several articles in which they praised me for slow traveling to the place of work, whereas everybody else took a plane. So yeah, it's something that in the past they really, yeah, also took some good press for my slow travel.
Gianluca, can you tell me about your research in Bougainville, in Papua New Guinea, researching the social psychology of climate change and climate risk through the lens of a risk-taking game. Tell me about this.
Yes, I actually carried out three different studies. So the main one has to do with the social cohesion. So that's one of the main overarching interests in my research agenda. So I'm interested in investigating whether, you know, big shocks, big existential threat like climate change make people more willing to help each other, more relying on, you know, the social networks of mutual aid, mutual exchange, or not. This is something that I researched during the COVID too, and we found that people who were more exposed to COVID were more inclined to help each other. So in a way, this is good news because it means that at times of risk for the group, for the society, people tend to help each other more. And actually, there was also other research reaching the same conclusion during the COVID. We ran this research in the US and Italy. It has already been published. So in a way, I wanted to replicate this research question to 30 different villages that were exposed to climate change. And we wanted to see again if a greater or lesser exposure to climate risks determined the higher or lower willingness to help each other. So that is the main research question on one study.
And that was in the Solomon Islands?
Yes, exactly, in Bougainville.
Now tell me about the risk-taking game and what it tells you about sense of fatalism.
Yes, that was another study that I decided to add because I really want to get as much information as possible. You know, I'm a researcher, so I'm really, in a way, obsessed with data and with knowledge. The research question there is how much insurance against risk people are prepared to take. And in a way, it's very hard to model climate change inside of a controlled decision environment. So this is what we try to do in experimental economics. We try to put people in front of a standardized situations of choices so that we can really compare very well what happens in different villages and even in different societies. And so in a way, climate change, it's clear, is a threat, is poses a risk to people. And we try to model climate change with a simple lottery, with a simple raffle in which people have some money and they can hold on to this money with a relatively low probability, with a high probability they will lose this money. So this is one option they have, stay inside this lottery and accept the risk. Or basically they can give up some money but have a safe option, a certain amount of money. So in monetary terms, they would either have a 30% probability of winning 5 kina. 5 kina, kina is the local currency in Papua New Guinea, or 70% probability of losing this 5 kina, or they could have a 2 kina for free. And when I give this type of choice to some people living in Europe or in North America, most people, I would say 70% of the people would choose the safe option because yeah, people tend to be risk averse. And it was so surprising to me to see so many people here in Bougainville, Papua New Guinea, going for the risky option. So about 95% of the people would choose the raffle, the risky option. And then we, in a way, we changed the rules of the game and we made the probability of winning the 5 kina lower and lower. So we had three decisions. In the last decision, the probability of winning the 5 kina would be as low as 1%. But even there, the vast majority of the people, close to, I think, 75% of the people, would still prefer the risky option rather than the safe option. And that's completely, I don't want to say crazy because I should, you know, be more neutral. But, you know, I thought that's really, really surprising.
And it's far greater risk-taking position than Europeans or North Americans would take.
Yes, yes, exactly. So now I'm really trying to, you know, understand why that is the case. And my hypothesis, and actually I, in a way, constructed this hypothesis on some, you know, conversations that I had while slow traveling to here. My hypothesis that people are at the same time fatalistic. So they believe that to some extent the future is already written by God or by some supernatural entity.
What evidence do you have, Gianluca, that fatalism in these communities where you carried out your research is associated with climate change? And the associated question is, what do these folks tell you about the impact of climate change on their lives individually and the lives of their communities?
Everybody talks about climate change. Probably sometimes even when climate change is not the responsible for the kind of change they are experiencing. But all coastal communities we visited, so all coastal communities that live close to the beach, already had one experience of relocation inland because of sea level rise. Actually, here in the Solomon Islands, there is both a process of sea level rise, as everywhere else in the world, and there is also a process of the land sinking because of the Australian tectonic plate is going on the top of the Solomon Islands tectonic plate. So this process of sea level rise is much quicker than in other places. So that's number one. And of course, it's annoying. But I wouldn't say it's life-threatening. So many times they experience earthquakes, but they haven't experienced the tsunamis, at least on the East Coast where we work. So this is something that, of course, it's very costly, but at least, their houses, they can be dismounted and remounted in another place. But what is really life-threatening is when the drought season comes. So normally they would have a dry season lasting 3 weeks, but now almost certainly as an effect of climate change, the dry season can last 6 weeks or even 8 weeks. And I heard many people, especially in mountain communities, are telling when the dry season lasts so long, we don't have any food. So we really run out of food and we have to ask our extended families, people from other villages, to give us some food. In our surveys, we have one question that is taken from the World Bank. It's part of the Food Sovereignty Index. And we ask how many nights inside the last month you go to sleep without having eaten the whole day. And about 15% of the people answered that they went to sleep without eating the whole day for several days in the last month. So that's really something that is very, very disturbing. And I really fear for the time in which, you know, that now temperatures have increased 1.2 degrees. The prediction is that at the current rate will exceed 1.5 the temperature increase in just 10 years. And so I really fear for these people when the temperature will go even higher than what they are now.
You told all 1,800 participants in your research project that you would return to Germany low carbon. You'd travel slowly. You would not fly. You'd travel slowly. What was their response to that?
Exactly. So I, in a way, you know, I really wanted to show in some kind of tangible way that I am with them and that I want to do the least I can do to lower their climate pain, their climate damage. As you know, the amount of carbon dioxide that a person from Europe emits is around 9.8 tons on average per year. Northern Americans are much worse, actually. Northern Americans emit about 20.7 tons of CO2 every year on average. People here in Bougainville probably don't emit more than 300 kilos of carbon dioxide every year. So, yeah, I mean, the difference is stunning. We are talking about 30 times more or even 60 times more carbon dioxide produced not just in 1 year, but over time. So it's clear that their damage, their climate damage, is not their fault. It's mainly the fault of us Europeans and Northern Americans, who have been the major emitters historically. So I'm not sure if ethically I have to take a responsibility of what my compatriots did in the past and are doing now. But even so, I wanted to tell them, okay, I'm with you, I'm close to you, so I'm trying to do what I can to reduce the climate damage that you are suffering. And so that's what I can do. You know, for a researcher, taking a plane can count as much as 90% of their carbon footprint. And so I was really committed to do so. And I think I could see their body language. When I made this announcement, they would really nod at me. I could see that they really approved my commitment, my promise. And that's also why I was so keen not to give in to the absurd request by my institute. I really want to keep the promise. You know, in the end, actions count much more than words. And many times because of, you know, the turbulent colonial past, white men, as I'm always referred to while I'm here, are referred to as a gyaman. Gyaman in Tok Pidgin means fraudster and liar. So I really didn't want that. Even if I would have a good excuse, you know, I could explain to them, look, if I don't take a plane, I'm going to get fired. But I really wanted to be consistent with my commitment through actions, not just through words. That's also part of the reason why I decided not to fly back.
You wrote in your recent essay for The Guardian, scientists who have reduced their carbon footprint are more likely to be persuasive with the public than scientists who have not.
Yes, that's correct. There is also a study making precisely this point, and it is an experimental study, so they manipulated the different conditions, so they presented vig nets to people, and the people who were faced with this story of a scientist who reduces their carbon footprint by a large amount, they were more inclined to believe in this scientist and to go along with what that this scientist was recommending. So, yeah, there is, I would say, uncontroversial scientific evidence showing commitment gives you much more credibility than just, you know, talking hot air, saying, yes, I'm going to do my best to reduce my carbon footprint, but you do that after you have caught a plane to travel to a conference.
So you now are on that proverbial slow boat back to Europe from the Pacific. It's actually a number of slow boats and a few trains. Can you tell me, Gianluca Grimalda, about your trip? Like, where are you now at this moment? And are you now plying some body of water? And what are the stages of your slow return back to Europe?
Yes, so, I mean, the slow travel is very, very slow at the beginning, and I kind of expected that, but let's say it's been even slower than what I thought, because the really difficult thing is really to getting out of these islands that are in the middle of the Pacific. There are only two services a month in the island where I am now, so that's why I took a cargo ship, and finding a cargo ship who was happy to carry me has not been easy. I had to ask to many people, and in the end I was lucky enough to find a owner who accepted me on board. So the next ferry will be from here to island of Papua. I plan to be at the border between Papua and Indonesia in 2-3 days. Then in Indonesia there is the National Ferry Company who travels up to Singapore. So I will stay on a ferry for about 10 days. And so my itinerary would be to travel through Malaysia, Thailand, then I'm not sure whether to travel through Laos or Cambodia and Vietnam. Then I will enter China. I will cross the border to Pakistan close to the Karakoram Range. Then I will go south to the border of Iran, cross to Iran, hoping that the war between Hamas and Israel has not escalated. So I will enter Iran, cut through Iran, enter Turkey, travel through Turkey, and then take a ferry to Greece, then take another ferry to Italy, and then basically I'm home. I'll just travel back to Germany by fast train.
Gianluca Grimalda, I'm grateful for your time. My last question, when you get back to Germany, you're going to be unemployed. You're going to be out on the street, as we say. But you know the old saying, with every door that closes, another door opens. I'm thinking this experience of yours and your slow travel back from Papua New Guinea, Bougainville to Germany plenty of time to write a book. Are you getting any book publishing offers?
Yeah, actually I do. So yeah, of course, many people tell me I've been mad to make this choice. Every friend I asked to before making this choice told me, no, there was not a single person who told me you are right. I also spoke with some journalists because I wanted to evaluate the media impact of my story. And journalists told me, nobody's going to talk about you. Maybe only very people from countries very sensitive to climate change, like the Netherlands, maybe Germany. But yeah, don't expect much audience. So just stick with your job. So I thought, yeah, maybe just, to really catch people by surprise, I'm going to make this choice. We are really living in unprecedented times. You must know that the temperature has increased by 1 degree Celsius in 250 years since we started burning fossil fuels in the Industrial Revolution. And there has never been a time before where temperature has increased by 1 degree in such a fast time. Normally, it would take 8,000 years, 10,000 years. So what we are experiencing is really crazy. So animal species have no time to adapt. That even human species have no time to adapt. So I'm really, really concerned. I'm really frightened by what can happen now, but even more in the time to come. So I thought, maybe this experience with my institute is an opportunity for me to sound the alarm as strongly as possible, to really shout as loudly as I can that we are really in a very, very bad situation. And in this time of basically ecosystems collapsing in front of our eyes today, the really insane thing is to get on with the business as usual. So I'm going to use this experience to really try to, sound the alarm as loudly as I can, that we are really not good. Net zero by 2050, that is the main policy used in Europe, is too late, is way too late. So I have been really massively surprised by the support that I have received during this time. I would have never experienced it. I would have never thought that my news would have been top of the chart on The Guardian when the article of my story came up. So, yeah, I thought that really that proved me right, that this was the right choice for me. And yes, I have received an offer to write a book. I have received offers to write columns on newspapers by many newspapers. So yeah, my life has changed. I've been invited to many TV programs in Italy, even in Germany. I'm confident that I can find another work in academia. So finding another job in academia is still my priority because I want to get on with my research work on climate change. And so, yeah, as you said, for one door that shuts, there will be for sure many doors that will open. And there is a legal case. So I'm going to start a legal case. And if I win this legal case, it means that every employee in Germany will have the right to say no to catch a plane on moral grounds, even if their employer forces them to do so.
Gianluca Grimalda, I wish you the best of luck, and we'll have to stay in touch. Thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Listen to my complete conversation with Gianluca Grimalda and follow his long, slow journey from Papua New Guinea to Germany at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Thank you. enjoyable parts of academic research is going to conferences in far-off places. Earlier this month, Radhika Desai traveled to Russia by plane, not boat, to attend a forum organized by the Valdai Discussion.